Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Wasn't it just a few weeks ago we were complaining how cold it was? Boy, things have changed. Going to be a hot weekend this weekend for those runners that are going to be out there. As everyone is warning, please hydrate. Drink lots of water or lots of fluids during that run up in Burlington, the Vermont City Marathon. A lot to get to today, and a lot of time. I've left a lot of time for you to call in, because I left a lot of people hanging on Wednesday on the phone lines because I really had to move on to our interviews at the Vermont Chamber of Commerce Business and Industry Expo. But what got everybody going, and we didn't get a chance to get you all on, but I'm going to give you a chance today. If you have some questions or some opinions about this, do you think that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the DNC, that's the Democratic National Committee, should be removed? Most Bernie supporters think she has rigged the system to ensure that Hillary wins, and wondering how she can bring people together after the convention if most Bernie supporters think that she was tipping the scales in favor of Hillary Clinton. And then on Wednesday, it was quite remarkable that we started to get calls that talked about whether Bernie is really a Democrat. Why should the Democrats be loyal to Bernie, some callers said, if he's not been a Democrat for a long time? As you know, Bernie Sanders is an independent. I'll open up the phone lines to continue this discussion of this question in a moment. Plus, Bill Lee, he's running for governor. Bill Lee, known as Spaceman, the former Red Sox and Expo pitcher who lives in Greensboro, is running for governor. Would you vote for Bill Lee? And if you vote for Bill Lee, why would you vote for Bill Lee? Be an interesting, I'm very interested in your phone calls on that subject. And then John Walters will join us right here in WDEV studios. John's from Vermont Political Observer, and he will join us and give us some insight and thoughts from his liberal perspective about various issues. And since yesterday was the filing deadline for candidates who are running for various offices here in Vermont, we'll get his perspective of who's running and why they're running and some of the issues that will be going into these campaigns. Then in the second hour, I want to switch the subjects totally. First, what I want to do is to give you a recap of the interview that I did with the Benghazi survivor, John Teagan, on Saturday night. And one of the things that I focused on in that interview were those 13 hours, the attack on the diplomatic compound that killed Ambassador Christopher Stevens and a communications officer, Sean Smith, at the diplomatic compound. That attack started on 9:38. There was another attack that happened at the CIA annex. All that ended 13 hours later, and I want to talk about that. Then Memorial Day is on Monday. And one of the things I want to ask is, what does Memorial Day mean to you? I'm finding that Memorial Day means different things to different people. And I'm just curious what Memorial Day means to you. It has a profound and somewhat different meaning to me than perhaps you. And it's not about travel. It's not about a holiday, at least to me. But I'd be very interested in your phone calls in terms of, in the second half of this program, what does Memorial Day mean to you? So as I look at it, the program with lots, it's a program today with lots of time for your phone calls. So if you wish to join the conversation, we're going to start out with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. If you want to call on that, this issue, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. And let me sort of set this up for you. Back on Wednesday when I did it and when we got a flood of phone calls about this, do you think that Debbie Wasserman Schultz should be removed from her position as chair of the DNC? Some reports on Wednesday were suggesting that there was this uneasiness, especially on Capitol Hill among some, that is growing, and some are calling for her removal. And Bernie Sanders has already said that he would not keep her if he was elected as president of the United States. In fact, Bernie Sanders is supporting her primary opponent. She's a congresswoman from Florida, and he is supporting Debbie Wasserman Schultz's primary opponent. So the question is, should Debbie Wasserman Schultz be removed from her position as chair of DNC? And I'm taking some of this information from the newspaper The Hill. And The Hill is a newspaper that covers everything on Capitol Hill. And Democrats on Capitol Hill have been discussing the possibility of removing Democratic National Committee Chairman Debbie Wasserman Schultz from her position prior to the party's convention this summer in Philadelphia. And there are two sides to this, because other high-ranking Democrats, including Florida Senator Bill Nelson and Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, has said that's not going to happen. She's not going to be removed. But there has been this talk on Capitol Hill. And according to The Hill, some Democrats really believe this, that Wasserman Schultz's ongoing battles with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has made her too divisive of a figure to unite the party ahead of this fall's campaign. And it is interesting in that Bernie Sanders has made no bones about criticizing Wasserman Schultz and by the way, the DNC. He's claimed that both have favored Hillary Clinton. He's criticized the party for scheduling debates on the weekend nights, for having closed primaries, and for the superdelegate process. And he says that has helped pad Clinton's lead. And in response, like I said, Sanders has gone out of his way to talk about the fact that he would replace her if he was president, and secondly, that he endorsed her primary opponent. So what do you think? Should Debbie Wasserman Schultz be removed from her position as chair of the DNC or not? And this is an interesting sort of side note, and it is a side note to this question here, is that the Washington Post, and by the way, the Washington Post has been very hard on Bernie Sanders, and you could say is probably leaning towards Hillary Clinton in its editorial page as you read the various editorials, but she was slammed, Hillary Clinton was slammed in an editorial a few days ago about emails. And it says Hillary Clinton's use of email while Secretary of State from 2009 to 2010 has been justifiably criticized as an era of judgment. And it goes on to say, you know, that the headline is Clinton's inexcusable, willful disregard for the rules. And it talks about the fact that the Inspector General of the State Department came out and was highly critical of how Hillary Clinton stored emails. And I guess, does that lead to the question, do these emails have any impact on the election? I mean, Bernie had said, I'm tired of talking about these damn emails. And was it an issue that he kind of dismissed. Will the American public dismiss those emails. It'll be interesting as this goes on. As you know, there's this IG investigation. There's also the FBI is investigating Hillary Clinton on these emails. Obviously, that report has not come out. One of the things that you heard Victoria Jones talk about when we talked about this on Wednesday, Thursday, actually, when we talked about this, one of the things that she said is what has made a lot of people scratch their head is that the former secretaries of state all came forward, were interviewed by the inspector general. Hillary Clinton refused to be interviewed by the inspector general for their investigation into emails. So the question we're asking right now, do you think that Debbie Wasserman Schultz should be removed from her position as chair of the DNC? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255 if you have an opinion. If you think that the chair, which is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, if you think that the chair of the Democratic National Committee has been playing favorites, give us a call. And if you think that she cannot unite the party after the primary because she has been playing favorites, because she will anger Bernie Sanders supporters, then give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Be very, very interested in your opinions. Let's, while we wait on your calls on that issue, let's talk about another issue, which is an editorial that I read today in the Rutland Herald, which is about Bruce Lee. And if you don't know Bruce Lee, then you're probably younger than I am. Bruce Lee spent many a year as a major league pitcher between the Boston Red Sox and the Montreal Expos. I think it was 11 years or 14 years that he pitched for either the Red Sox or the Montreal Expos. And his nickname was the Spaceman. So Bill Lee is running for governor. And one of the things, and I started to talk about this yesterday, and I'll get to the editorial in the Rutland Herald, Bill Lee has said that he's been fielding so many phone calls, he's beginning to have second thoughts about his run for Vermont governor. And some of the things that he's talking about in terms of his policies that he would do, he believes that we should eliminate the border between Canada and the United States. He wants to form an alliance with Quebec and the Canada's maritime provinces to harness wave energy from the Bay of Fundy. Closer to home, he wants to set up a new ride-sharing system to help residents of rural Vermont get around. Bill Lee is 70 years old, and he will be running on the Liberty Union ticket. And it's interesting. He got his nickname Spaceman while pitching in Boston in the 1970s when he would digress in these interviews, if you remember, into lofty subjects and had brash ideas about a variety of subjects. He's run for president before on the Rhinoceros Party ticket in 1988. And he describes himself as a socialist, a liberal with a gun, and says he's a big fan of Bernie Sanders. So my question is this. Would you vote for Bill Lee, and why? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Two questions on the plate. One of them is, do you think Debbie Wasserman Schultz should step down or should be removed from her office as chair of the Democratic National Committee? Is she too biased to bring the party together, assuming that Hillary Clinton wins? Will Bernie Sanders supporters feel that she rigged the system? If you remember, Bernie Sanders came out very, very strongly about a week ago, saying that the system is rigged, that his supporters are profoundly frustrated and thinks that the system is rigged. This was in the aftermath of a ruckus in the Nevada State Convention between Hillary Clinton supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters, where they felt they were railroaded in that process. So that's one question. The other question is, would you support Bill Lee, the former Red Sox left-hander who now lives in Craftsbury? Would you support, and his nickname Spaceman, would you support him running for governor? Would you vote for him running for governor, and the reasons why? I am very curious about this, so give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. The Rutland Herald did an editorial today on Bill Lee, and it was an interesting editorial in that it said many of the same things that I have said here. It talked about his background. It talked about the quirkiness sometimes of his comments. It talked a lot about the fact that, you know, he supported Bernie Sanders. And I think at one point he was quoted on WCAX, at least, of saying, you know, I was Bernie Sanders before Bernie Sanders was Bernie Sanders. So, you know, he has this interesting history in politics. And the conclusion of the editorial is, Bill Lee is in a position to provide something that is sorely needed during this campaign season: humor. Millions of voters look ahead with grim foreboding and a sense of dread. There is a player out there with no respect for the game. Lee ought to remind us that playing the game with joy makes it come out better in the end. So, do we need more humor in our political process in Vermont? And would you vote for Bill Lee, and why? So those are some of the questions that I'm asking today. It is interesting what is happening in terms of politics this year. Who could have predicted? Who could have predicted the political year that we have had this year? Who would have predicted long ago that Donald Trump would be the nominee of the Republican Party? Who would have predicted that Bernie Sanders would have come so close to Hillary Clinton? And who would have predicted that Bill Lee would be running for governor? If you had predicted that, give me a call, because I want some of your take in Vegas. It's 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Speaking of sort of unpredictability, one of the things that I was interested in, at least looking at the Democratic State Convention here in Vermont, was the fact that John Tracy, a high-ranking staffer in Senator Patrick Leahy's office, I think the state director, actually, in Senator Patrick Leahy's office, was running to be a national chairperson in the Vermont National Chairperson. That person represents Vermont at the National Democratic Committee. And one of the things that I was surprised about is that he was not voted in as a chairperson, national chairperson, going to the national, Democratic National Committee. And what surprised me about that, and what I haven't figured out yet, is there some major dissatisfaction within the party? And this may be an indication, but is there major dissatisfaction with Senator Patrick Leahy's superdelegate vote? Remember, he has committed to Hillary Clinton long ago. He sort of nuanced that position later on as Bernie started gaining traction. But is there true sort of uneasiness, frustration, concern about Senator Patrick Leahy's position with his superdelegate vote. So that will be an interesting thing to watch. I just presumed, and maybe I was wrong. Obviously, I was wrong with this. I just presumed that John Tracy would be a shoo-in, which leads to the other question, and we'll talk to John Walters about this in a little while. Does Scott Milne have a chance? Yesterday, he announced that he's running against Senator Patrick Leahy. So the question is, does he have a chance? Many of us, including me, by the way, discounted his chance against Governor Shumlin in the last election. And guess what? He came in within a whisker of beating Shumlin. We all underestimated him. So my question is, does Scott Milne have a chance? I don't know. You know, normally you would say no. And in a presidential year, you would say no. But who knows? Is there something going on there? Is the superdelegate sort of issue among Bernie Sanders supporters sort of causing a rub with Senator Patrick Leahy? And also, Senator Leahy is caught up in this EB-5 email problem where he has refused to release his emails. And the issue of it seems contradictory. I mean, Senator Leahy, who has written numerous endorsements of the Media Sunshine Week to promote government transparency, flatly refused a request by Scott Milne, his now general election opponent, to release the emails. And you may say, well, he has to release the emails if he's requested. No, he doesn't. Unlike Governor Peter Shumlin, where his office, the governor's office, is required by law to comply with requests to produce public records, including emails, the U.S. Congress conveniently exempts itself from such request, even though the rest of the federal government must comply. And this is an interesting sort of position. You know, most members of Congress, and it's not only Senator Leahy, but most members of Congress will advocate transparency and celebrate and endorse Sunshine Week. But, of course, that's for others, not for them. And this double standard, I don't think, sits well with constituents. They're shaking their heads saying, why does that double standard exist? So a bunch of questions. We've gone all over the map out there in terms of politics this first half hour. Wanted to get to a lot of stuff we just haven't gotten to during the week. Wanted to just throw it out there for you. If you have an opinion or comment, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Ruth and Sheldon. Ruth, you're on open mic.
Good morning.
Good morning.
When you were giving the on WCAX the Republican viewpoint of what was going on in the gubernatorial race, you were very down on Scott Milne. Well, you not only underestimated Scott, but you underestimated the people of Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I do think he has a very good chance of winning Patrick Leahy's seat. And I think the people of Vermont are seeing that the Liberal Democrats are destroying what we have in this country and in our state. And we are being affected personally. So we have to change this. We have to turn it around. But it may be too late because there's so many people who benefit from the Liberal Democratic programs, while the people who are paying for it are suffering.
Thanks, Ruth. Thank you for your phone call. Ruth has it right. I was wrong. I thought that Scott Milne would not be a serious challenger to Governor Shumlin. I underestimated just how unpopular the current governor is. I won't do that again. No matter what people tell me, I think the test is called the parade test, and I think Governor Shumlin has found out that when he goes to parades, it's not a very overwhelming response that he gets. Let's go back to the phone lines and Gene and Barry. Gene, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Do you think if Bernie got elected as president that he would run as a Democrat? No way. He would run it as an independent. And Trump would be the same way. I call Trump an independent, too. Why do you think people are so enthused of listening to Trump and Bernie? Because their theories are so much different from Democrats and Republicans. So it's got them all interested. They're paying attention because this campaign is so much different, because before it was like Democrat and Republican. Well, this time it's not.
Gene, you raise a good issue in that I think there's something going on out there, and I'm going to ask John Walters when he comes on in the next segment. I'm going to ask him about this. There is something going on there that I don't think I have sort of got my arms around out there. But when you have Bernie so popular, he look, I said this early on, and I said it very early when Bernie announced. He's got a message. I didn't realize how much it would catch fire, but he's got a message. Donald Trump has a message, and it is catching fire. And there's something going on out there. When Donald Trump can walk into the state of Vermont and generate an enormous crowd at the Flynn Theater with people that don't get in and were waiting in line, there's something going on. And I don't – there seems to be this unease, this restlessness across the country. And I don't think Vermont is immune from it. And I'm trying to get my hand on what that is. Let's go to Rob in Shelburne. Rob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, this is Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I think that part of what's going on is that the parties are needing reform. I think the dissatisfaction within the Democratic Party has a lot to do with the fact that the Democrats are starting to follow the money in the same way that the Republican Party has traditionally followed the money, and I think Democrats are pretty disgruntled with that. I think a lot of the anti-Hillary sentiment comes from the corporate donations that came in through Hillary into the party, and pretty much got the superdelegates lined up behind Hillary with that corporate influence. And I think Pat Leahy was probably involved in that. He declared very early in it his loyalty to Hillary, and I think somehow that corporate money has something to do with it. And I think that when the Republican Party and the Democratic Party start to look like the same thing, people get really upset and they go for people outside. Now, I think Bernie's ideas are great, and I think Donald hasn't really articulated any ideas except that he's playing on the emotions of anger. Well, that's about all I got to say.
Thanks, Rob, and you're absolutely right. They've both have tapped into some different people they've tapped into, but they've both tapped into somebody. Let's go to Bob in Montpelier. Bob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, I just thought I'd address that the comment, I think it was Jean from Barry, has made. I heard her call, and she's obviously a Hillary supporter, which is fun. Bernie, I think a lot of people that support Bernie don't feel that he isn't a Democrat. They feel that he represents the Roosevelt and Martin Luther King ideas of socialist. He gave a speech at Georgetown where he used examples from both Roosevelt speeches in that. Where the Democratic Party is now, thanks to Hillary's husband, Bill, and triangulation, I don't think the Democratic Party is anything like Democratic. And what the previous caller said is true about why people are for Trump and Bernie on different ends of the spectrum is because they're sick of the status quo.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say the BS, but you said the status quo.
Well, it was, I'm on the radio. Yeah, basically. But I think it's important that Bernie is, whether he runs as an independent or a Democrat, I wish he'd run as an independent, actually, because he, I think he would do better with that. But I think he is representing what the Roosevelt type Democrats were.
And we're talking Franklin Roosevelt. We're not talking...
talking Franklin Roosevelt, yes.
Right.
You know, Social Security, that type of thing.
Right.
Jobs, you know, all the, his programs for infrastructure.
Right. Hey, Bob, thank you for your phone call. Great phone calls coming in with great comments, and we're talking sort of a range of issues here. But what struck many people is the unease of the voter out there, and what is causing that. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. A couple of comments. First of all, with all due respect to a previous caller, Bernie Sanders is no independent, at least based upon how I describe or what I traditionally think of as an independent. Mm-hmm. He votes 99.9% of the time with Democrats. People say he doesn't owe anything to anybody. He does. George Soros is a big funder of his, and so aren't the unions. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that there are people who support him, and he does have, you know, issues in order to continue getting funding from them. And I know a lot comes from independent people within the country. That's great, but, you know, I don't think he's that much different than others. But with regards to the constituency of both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, I think what they've done is they've just given a voice or given a voice to people who think they don't have a voice or haven't been represented over the years. That would be the young, for the most part, and some minority groups of Bernie. And it would be the flyover, you know, mid part of the country and some of the southern states where hardworking blue-collar people don't think that government really represents them and their values. And I think that's really where some of the, you know, because they feel like they haven't been dealt with over the years, there's a little bit of anger that comes along with both those groups.
Paul, thank you for your phone call. Thank all of you for your phone call. Great, great segment with calls that just people are thinking out there, and people have great comments, and I really appreciate that. When we come back, we'll talk with John Walters and get his perspective on Vermont politics, mostly who's in, who's out, and what is going on with... We'll ask that question. What is going on out there? Is there something going on out there? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome into our WDEV studios John Walters from Vermont Political Observer. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mike. It's a great season to be a talk show host or a political blogger,
isn't it? this is what we love. I think yesterday was the filing deadline for candidates running for election. So let's talk about who's in and who's out. Who's in on the Democratic side, and who would you sort of handicap? How would you handicap that?
Well, we have, unless there was somebody I missed, we have Matt Dunn, former state senator, and Sue Minter, former transportation secretary, and Peter Galbraith, former state senator. And it's an interesting three-way, it's an interesting triangle, I actually called it this, and the lieutenant governor race, which I'm sure we'll get to, has a kind of a similar triangulation going on. You have a mainstream, sort of a mainstream Democratic, longtime Democrat, in this case Matt Dunn. You have another sort of longtime Democrat who happens to be a woman, Sue Minter, and you have a person who's trying to position himself as an outsider, Peter Galbraith. There's a similar setup in the Democratic race for lieutenant governor, but it raises a bunch of questions that at this point really can't be answered. Do Dunn and Minter split the mainstream vote and give Galbraith an open lane on the left? Do Galbraith and Dunn split the male vote and Sue Minter gets the votes of those who would like to see another Democrat, another woman governor? Because Vermont has had a very bad track record of giving women access to high office. So I'm sure there are those who would, if they had to flip a coin in the race, would vote for Sue Minter over the other two. I think Peter Galbraith is the third place finisher in this because he alienated a lot of people in the party and in political office when he was in the state Senate. He may have a lot of money in his campaign account, but so do the other two. And I think his distance from the Democratic Party is going to be a fatal handicap to him. Dunn and Minter, I think it's going to be really close. And at this point, I have no idea. Neither of them has really caught fire yet. Both of them have plenty of time to catch fire. I would think that Dunn would be a very, very slight favorite, but really it's essentially a toss-up, I think.
Comes down to ground game probably at this point.
Yeah, especially the thing to consider, to keep in mind, is that this is our first year with a primary in August, which is going to mean low turnout. And that's a case where if you have a devoted following or a strong ground game, you may be able to win with a relative handful of votes.
Let's turn to the Republicans. We have two running for on the Republican side, Phil Scott and Bruce Lissman.
Yep.
How do you handicap that race?
Well, I think just about every Republican in the state wants Phil Scott to win, I think. Bruce Lissman is doing something interesting, which is really his only path to a possible hope for the nomination, which is to try to move to Phil Scott's right. Which is an interesting maneuver for him because he always talked of himself as a nonpartisan and a lifelong Democrat when he was running campaign for Vermont. But now he's moving to the right. He's attacking Phil Scott for Phil Scott's closeness to the Shumlin administration, and that's a fair criticism because Phil Scott was in Shumlin's cabinet for most of the time they were in office. Still, though, Phil Scott is immensely personally popular, and I think Republicans have been looking toward him ever since Jim Douglas left office as the great hope for the next governor. And I think a lot of people, some people don't like Phil Scott, some very conservative Republicans, and I think they will migrate to Bruce Lissman, but I don't think that'll come anywhere near enough to topple Phil Scott in the Republican primary.
What are some of the issues that are going to pop up in these primaries, both on the Democrat side and on the Republican side?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic, and I just wrote about this last night, where the Democratic and Republican races are shaping up as having entirely different and mutually contradictory visions of where Vermont is, where we need to go, and what Vermonters want. You know, Republicans, Phil Scott is a relatively moderate Republican, but he is saying very strongly that Vermonters are sick of taxes. We have an affordability crisis, as he says every time he opens his mouth. There's too much getting in the way of business and economic growth, mostly from the government. And there's too much sort of busyness and constant innovation, constant uproar and churn in the political system, and we need to step back from that. That's Phil Scott's vision. And he believes, and Republicans believe, that that's where the sentiment of the voters is. Now, the Democrats are in this Bernie Sanders mania, where Bernie took 86% of the Democratic presidential primary vote, and they look at that as a validation of the idea that what we need is more liberalism, more progressive legislation, that Governor Shumlin's main problem was that he wasn't dramatic enough in what he tried to do, issue after issue.
Many believe that Governor Shumlin's problem was Governor Shumlin.
Well, that's another thing. But you know, a lot of progressives have said almost ever since Governor Shumlin took office that he is being too incremental in what he's trying to do rather than trying to make a dramatic change in a number of areas, tax reform, human services. He tried in, you know, healthcare reform. But the idea, and reinforced by Bernie Sanders' popularity, is that the Democrats need to run to the left this year. So, you know, you have Matt Dunn and Sue Minter and Peter Galbraith all coming out in favor of a $15 minimum wage and, you know, paid family leave. You know, we just barely passed paid sick leave. Family leave is a much bigger deal. And that would have been unthinkable even a few months ago. And now it's on the table. So, you know, we're going to have a real contest of ideas this fall, whoever the Democratic nominee is against Phil Scott, because, you know, it's do you think Vermont needs to take a step back and, you know, take the foot off the accelerator and cut taxes and cut regulation? Or do you think we need to just, you know, put the pedal to the metal? to use one of Phil Scott's racing analogies.
One of the things that you had mentioned, it, this is going to be a fun year. One of the things that makes it so fun, I think, is that are we commentators missing something out there? I mean, is there something that Bernie has tapped into that actually Trump has tapped into something as well?
Yeah.
Is there something we're just missing and Vermonters are just as restless as the rest of the country?
Well, you know, as I just said, I think the commentariat, no matter where we are, you know, we're not hanging out at the bars and the coffee shops, and we're not living normal lives, really, in a lot of ways. You know, we're not, you know, working a blue-collar job. So, you know, it's hard to stay in touch with the concerns of people like that. And it's easy to get caught up in the political, you know, we all live in the political bubble. And it's a lot smaller bubble, and it's a lot more permeable bubble here than it is in Washington, D.C., but it's a bubble nonetheless. What I can't figure out is exactly what the people do want. I think there's a lot of restlessness out there, but, you know, Trump and Sanders are both tapping into that, but they're offering vastly different prescriptions for what to do about it. And, you know, the electorate is split on that. So exactly what is going on, I have no idea. I just know there's something going on.
When we come back, let's turn to the lieutenant governor's race. Mm-hmm. We'll see if we can get some more time with you as well. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in studio John Walters, from Vermont Political Observer. We're talking all things politics right now in Vermont. And we started out with the governor's race. John, I'm going to ask you a big favor, is that I'm looking at all the questions I have. We're going to run out of time here at the top of the hour. Can you stay over and then at 10:15 to 10:30,
yeah, sure.
Could you come back? I'd appreciate it.
And your plan for the second hour was Memorial Day, and I have a little family Memorial Day story of my own, and maybe we can get that in the next half hour.
Let's do that, because I'm going to take the last half hour and talk about Memorial Day. Yeah. Let's go and talk about the lieutenant governor's race. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Let's go D's first, R second. I'm doing it alphabetically.
Yes. Well, Shap Smith's entry into the race is certainly a bombshell. The sense I had gotten before Shap had entered the race is that Kesha Ram really wasn't capturing the imagination of the bulk of Democrats. And that David Zuckerman, the progressive senator, really was being a very effective, very energetic campaigner and really did have his base solidly in his pocket. So if the race had stayed as it was, I would say Zuckerman would have won pretty easily in the August primary, especially given the turnout issues with an early August primary. Shap Smith entering the race changes everything. He's going to have a hard time beating David Zuckerman, especially in an August primary, and especially since, you know, he will to some extent split the quote-unquote Democratic vote with Kesha Ram. I don't know. She insists she's going to stay in the race. She has had a very effective fundraising operation so far, so I do not doubt that she is serious about that. The question is how much of the support will either openly or behind closed doors shift over to Shap Smith. You know, will Rahm start having trouble getting her phone calls returned? Will people suddenly have excuses for not showing up at rallies and stuff like that? Shap Smith is a very formidable political figure. To some extent, that's been on display during his time as Speaker, and to some extent, it really hasn't been, because he has always positioned himself as a team player and as someone who is devoted to getting an agenda through and being a practical leader and not pushing ideas that aren't ready for prime time. So we don't entirely know what Shap Smith would do if he were actually in an executive position. And, of course, he's not running for an executive position right now. But what is Shap Smith's own agenda? What would he do if he had his finger, you know, on the levers? We don't entirely know that yet. But I think it's going to be a close and very exciting race. between Smith and Zuckerman for lieutenant governor. And as I said, as I wrote in my blog when Schaap entered the race, we kind of have the two best campaigners on the Democratic side, both running for lieutenant governor, which is kind of weird. But it's going to be a very interesting, a lot more interesting than the usual lieutenant governor race, that's for sure.
What's interesting sometimes is that we often think, and, you know, again, we're in the bubble sort of to talk about it, but we often think that the name recognition of a Speaker of the House is much greater than it actually is. And if, in fact, if you go back and look at poll numbers over the years, you find that they have very low name recognition up there. Mm-hmm. As, by the way, as does the lieutenant governor. There's only three people that really have major rate name recognition: Senator Patrick Leahy, Bernie Sanders, and whoever's the sitting governor out there. Mm-hmm. So it's not that Schaap Smith has he has enough name recognition, but he doesn't have a lot of name recognition.
Well, he has a lot of pull in party circles,
right,
and that's going to give him a lot of energy and a lot of support. The other thing he would have had going for him if he had gone in the race earlier is he would have had the House Democratic Caucus behind him, and those are people who are on the ground in their districts around the state, and they form the outline of a very strong statewide political campaign. A lot of them went for Keisha Rahm when she announced for a lieutenant governor. The question is, how many are still with Schaap Smith? How many might edge away from Keisha and go toward Schaap? And to what extent can he build a statewide operation on, standing on the shoulders of his House caucus members?
We've got about a minute left here, minute and a half left. Just let's switch to AG and Auditor of Accounts. I don't want to spend a lot of time. Deborah Buckham is going to be running against T.J. Donovan, who has a lot of money and a lot of name recognition in Chittenden County, and Dan Feliciano, who is going to be running against the incumbent Auditor of Accounts. What are their chances?
Well, I would say they're not good. I don't think they're going to be competitive. I do give full credit to the Republican Party for finding credible candidates. They have had trouble in recent years filling out their statewide ticket. And it is better for all of us when the incumbents have a challenge and have to answer for their performance. So I certainly welcome their entry into the race. Dan Feliciano is a very nuts and bolts kind of a guy. He's a very conservative guy. But he's a very nuts-and-bolts kind of guy, and he would probably make a pretty darn good auditor. Doug Hoffer is on the other side of the political spectrum, but he is also a very solid nuts-and-bolts guy. He has earned a lot of respect for his work, and I don't think he'll have any trouble. And T.J. Donovan, I think, just has too many advantages for Deb Bucknum to overcome. And she also has the stain on her resume of having had her law license almost suspended in the early 90s.
When we come back, what I'd like to do is talk about Scott Milne versus Leahy, and that will be after we talk with our friends at Talk Media News. But we're speaking with John Walters from Vermont Political Observer. And in the second hour, we'll have John back in for just a brief, about 15 minutes or so, to end up this segment, because we went long with the first segment. But I also want to get to this, and it's Memorial Day is Monday. What does Memorial Day mean to you? It has a profound and somewhat different meaning to me. It's not about travel. It's not about the holiday. It does have a meaning, and I really want to spend some time talking about that. And in this, we'll spend about 30 minutes of the final half hour of the program talking about Memorial Day. It's an appropriate time to speak about Memorial Day. A lot of people have different opinions about Memorial Day. I have a different opinion, and I would be interested in yours. So that's what we're going to be doing when we come back. We're going to check in with our friends at Talk Media News and come back with your phone calls with John Walters and Memorial Day. What's it mean to you? This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from
Barry and Serving the Kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We turn our attention to national issues with one of our faves, Bob Ney. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I have goosebumps over Bernie Sanders.
Well, that was going to be my first question. Are we going to see a Sanders-Trump debate?
He's a genius. Sanders is a genius. You know, he poses this question to be posed of Trump. Trump says yes. I think there's a possibility the networks are going to get into a bidding war. Trump said $10 million to charity. CNN will be saying, well, I'll do 15 and Fox will do 20. I think it has a possibility. Trump doesn't get hurt. Bernie wins. Trump causes more division within the Democratic Party, but Bernie slingshots into California off of this. I think it could throw him over the edge. He could win California, and then it's game on. I don't care what anybody says or delegates ahead, but Hillary Clinton, it's game on.
I'm interested in that. How is it game on? Because it is by the delegate count, it's almost over unless the superdelegates start switching over to Bernie.
Well, remember Hillary Clinton, who was the anointed one, it was her turn, had all the superdelegates, and a young upstart named Barack Obama said, I don't think so. And they all turned within days on Hillary Clinton. She had them. They turned. And that same thing can happen. Combine it with the Inspector General's report. Hillary Clinton's probably going to be deposed in federal court. The FBI is going to sit down with her soon. And I'm not saying she's going to be indicted, but combine California win with that with Bernie Sanders. Superdelegates have to be saying, let me think about this.
One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was the fact that the Washington Post came out with a blistering editorial against Hillary Clinton on this Inspector General's report. State Department Inspector General said basically she mishandled emails and didn't follow procedures in the email process that they have established, secure procedures in the email process. Does this really make a difference?
Well, yeah, well, it does because, and again, you know, I have friends that are like, oh, Bob, this is nothing. Well, this is something. And it's legally something because, yeah, Colin Powell did it. John Kerry did it. Well, you know what? Number one, they're not running for president. Number two, they sat down with the Inspector General. Remember Hillary Clinton was going to cooperate?
Yeah,
she and her staff refused to sit down with the Inspector General. Refused. Obstruction of justice? I mean, there's a lot going down here legally. A ham sandwich can be indicted. Let me just say that. But when you're dealing with the FBI, and if they recommend further investigation and justice says no, and that leaks out officially that they recommended further investigation, it's just going to make mounting trouble. So I think she has a legal problem. Not that she be indicted, but I think she needs to quit talking about the email. And that's horrible for a political person. When I got in trouble, I wanted to talk, and my lawyers would call me and say to me, shut up, you're destroying your case. And I said, but I have to answer. You know. So Hillary Clinton's caught. To give her a benefit of the doubt, she's caught in that.
And just not so we don't confuse people, that this was an Inspector General's report by the State Department. There are sort of independent inspectors that look at various departments. This was an Inspector General's report that works with the State Department. There's also an FBI investigation going on. Is that correct?
Yes. Obama appointed Inspector General. Obama appointed FBI, if you catch the drip. That's why you don't hear this is a vast right-wing conspiracy out of Hillary's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
She can't say that. This is her side of the aisle, and that's a problem. Yes, it's the Inspector Generals 99.9% of the time are very, very, you know, unpolitically motivated, if I can put it that way.
One of the things that, just following up on your, I mean, the Clinton machine, are they concerned or are they going to keep all these superdelegates from falling off them?
Well, what they're doing through money and power, and I call it the House of Clinton, you know, the political system of Clinton, they're, you know, trying to hold these people at bay. But, you know, Jeb Bush had $100 million. He was a Bush. He had Karl Rove, and he had, you know, all these people, and Mitt Romney, and look what happened to him. Mm-hmm. So in this day and age of a different political society that we live in now, I don't care, you know, who the Clintons know or how many of these delegates are best ever friends. If this starts to crumble, which it is, and this goes on longer, which it will, I just argue that she is in serious trouble. I think she's in trouble right now because, and again, no offense to Bernie Sanders, I served with the man. I happen to really respect him tremendously, and I think he's an honest guy, but, you know, he had no business taking this many states from Hillary Clinton. No business.
So what happens? Will the because now you're talking about chaos. And
absolutely.
And so when you've got this much chaos, are we talking about somebody stepping in at the convention?
Yeah, I mean, this is chaos of epic proportions. And what will happen, let's say hypothetically, Bernie slingshots into California, he beats Hillary Clinton, some superdelegates start to change, and you've got this convention where you just don't know, is it Hillary or Bernie, all right? And all of a sudden you will get some on the Democratic side saying, hey, Joe Biden, polish your shoes up, put your tie on, and come downtown, Philadelphia, all right? That will work about as successfully as Mitt Romney trying to get a third-party candidate against Donald Trump. It won't work. It's too late. It's got to be Bernie or Hillary. It just won't work.
Well, that's well, it is certainly, you know, it's a good time, as I have a another commentator with me here today, but it's a good time to be in politics, Bob.
This could keep those of us in politics employed for a long, long time. Plus, this is going to be a course taught in universities for decades.
Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Have a great
today.
Week and Memorial Day with our veterans.
Same to you. Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Coming up, a little bit more with John Walters because I didn't get through all the questions. And then let's have a discussion about Memorial Day. What's it mean to you? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to be speaking with John Walters from Vermont Political Observer. We're talking about state politics, and given the fact that the deadline for candidates filing was yesterday, we have a lot to talk about. And the next sort of race I want to talk about is the federal race, the U.S. Senate race, Scott Milne versus Patrick Leahy. What's your take on that?
Well, I will start with the disclaimer that you gave in the first hour, which is that I didn't think Scott Milne had a chance in 2014 against Peter Shumlin, and I was wrong, just like everybody else except Scott Milne, I believe. And I'll tell you right off the top, I think he doesn't have a chance against Patrick Leahy. And I'll give you a couple of I'll give you one big reason why, and it's the difference between a presidential year and a non-presidential year. Scott Milne in 2014 had this miracle campaign. That's the narrative. He almost knocked off Peter Shumlin. Well, you look at the numbers. Randy Brock in 2012 ran what seemed like a disastrous campaign. He lost badly to Peter Shumlin. It was kind of an embarrassment. He got 111,000 votes. Scott Milne got 87,000 votes. He underpulled Randy Brock by 24,000. The difference in that race was Peter Shumlin lost almost half of his vote from 2012 to 2014. And part of that was his own unpopularity. A lot of it was the difference between a presidential year and a non-presidential year. We're in a presidential year this year. Scott Milne, the average difference in the Vermont electorate, it goes up by about 50%. If you compare a non-presidential year to a presidential year. So Scott Milne is going to have to find at least 30 or 40,000 votes, more like 50, really, maybe even more, if he's going to be competitive with Pat Leahy. And I don't see how he does that.
One of the things, and we've had lots of calls about this,
yeah.
People really peeved about the senator supporting Hillary Clinton. I mean, emotions run high to the fact that they were going to write in Bernie Sanders and for president,
yep.
And really peeved about the superdelegate vote of Senator Leahy and, to some extent, his EB-5 email refusal to give his emails over. Does that have any impact on him?
I think it does. I don't think it's enough to lose him the election or even come close to it. You know, it's the first time in his lifetime in the Senate where there's even a hint of any liberal unhappiness with Pat Leahy. But he still is the godfather of Vermont politics, and I'll believe he's lost the state when I see it and not before. If Scott Milne gives him a race and comes close or even beats him, then I will come on the air the day after Election Day and say, I was wrong again. I will never doubt Scott Milne again. But for now, I remain a Scott Milne skeptic.
Matt Dunn the other day said right here that there's a lack of trust in Vermont government, and he cited the health care exchange. He cited Norm McAllister. He cited several other things as well. Mm-hmm. Is there a lack of trust in state government?
I think there is a general mistrust of government at all levels. I'm not sure it's different or the same in Vermont than it is anywhere else. I think a lot of people who might normally be on the liberal side look at government and say, it's not doing enough for me and for my family and for, you know, my town. And that's a fair criticism. And that is why you have both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being so popular, is that people are looking for something different than what's been going on lately. And I think that to the extent that there is a feeling that Vermont government is out of touch or ethically iffy, then the people inside the bubble haven't gotten that message yet. We saw that with the complete failure of the drive to enact an ethics commission, with key senators openly saying, I don't think we have an ethics problem here. And, you know, you have Norm McAllister being arrested on the State House grounds. You got Bill Sorrell, the attorney general, facing an independent investigation. He was ultimately cleared, but it was the first time, I believe, in Vermont history that we had to have an independent investigator for our top law enforcement official. You've had a constant revolving door in government. It's been very dramatic during the Shumlin administration, but it's been true before that as well. And that raises questions when you see Alex McLean, for instance, going from Governor Shumlin's office to Jay Peek and repping Bill Stenger and EB-5 and then quitting and becoming a lobbyist. What does that say about the administration's chumminess with what turned out to be a Ponzi-like fraud scheme in EB-5? So I think Vermonters have abundant reason to mistrust their government and to want some sort of change and greater transparency. And I think that's why you see candidates in both parties making very similar pitches on ethics and transparency.
Governor Shumlin is touting this poll.
He finally got a good poll.
This poll that is out there, it's got some, I would say, methodological sort of problems with it, but he's touting this poll that shows him at 55% approval rating. Do you believe that poll?
No. Okay. This was a national survey that covered all 50 states, and they did a massive job of it. And I think they're, for the most part, they're pretty accurate. But, you know, as Rich Clark, the Castleton pollster, pointed out, their sample size in Vermont was a couple hundred people, and that's just not enough to be accurate. The margin of error is pretty large for a poll, and the chance of a dramatic error is pretty great. And then you have the last three Castleton surveys of Shumlin's popularity, and they're pretty much identical. He's, you know, upper 30s, low 40s in every case. And until we see another poll or two reflecting, you know, 55% support for Shumlin, I remain highly skeptical of that. And I don't think any Democratic candidate should take this poll as a reason to suddenly embrace Peter Shumlin.
And that's sort of my last question. What will be Peter Shumlin's sort of role in this next election? And how will the candidates view him? Will they use some of his policy? Will they embrace him, or will they distance themselves, especially the Democratic?
Yeah, I don't think you've seen any of them embracing him so far. Even Sue Minter, who was in his cabinet, She was in his administration for practically the whole run, and she has not really mentioned his name much at all. So I think you'll see Shumlin politically smart enough to kind of stay out of it. And I think you will see the Democratic candidates trying desperately to fashion their own images going forward, and not knocking Peter Shumlin, but also just not mentioning his name very much.
John, we're going to be switching subjects to Memorial Day here in just a moment after we finish up here. Do you have any thoughts about Memorial Day?
Well, I wanted to just tell a brief story because, I'm sure every family has their story. But my mother grew up in Cadillac, Michigan, and she was in a poor family, very poor family. They were moving constantly and always on the edge. And she had five brothers and sisters. The one who was closest to her in age, and also they were the closest of the siblings, he was by far her favorite brother or sister, Morris Wilson. And when World War II broke out, he lied about his age,
as a lot of people did.
Enlisted in the military. I don't remember if he was 15 or 16, but he lied about his age, got in the military, went over to Europe, and was killed. And I liked my mother's siblings. They're all different personalities and all that. But I always wished I'd gotten a chance to know Morris because he was by far her favorite of the relatives. When he died, they had never had a home. They'd just been in a succession of rental homes, often getting evicted and moving on because of not paying the rent. The only time they were able to buy a house was after they got his death benefit. And they finally had a stable home for quite a while after that. But that was his legacy to the Wilson family and to my mom. And like I say, I always wish I'd gotten a chance to know him. I certainly honor his service and think about him on Memorial Day.
John Walters, Vermont Political Observer, great, great way to end this segment. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Mike.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're dancing here in the studio. I want to switch subjects completely from politics right now, and it's this upcoming holiday, Memorial Day holiday. I had a veteran approach me yesterday to remind me that Memorial Day is not a day to thank a vet. By the way, we should be thanking a vet every day, but especially in November on Veterans Day. But Memorial Day is a day to honor those that have died serving their country. It has a history that goes back to the Civil War and was declared a national holiday in 1971, I believe it was. I was in the service at the time, I think, when it was declared a national holiday. I mean, many that talk about Memorial Day talk about specifically those that have been killed in wars. And that sort of has been the tradition of talking about Memorial Day, those that have been killed in wars, whether we buy a poppy from the American Legion. But as I explained at the top of the program, I sort of have a different definition, and I don't know if you agree or not, but my definition includes those that are killed while serving their country, whether in a war zone or elsewhere, because they've put themselves in harm's way. And oftentimes, it's in training, it's in an accident, it's something that is different than a combat role. And even though they've been in combat, sometimes people are killed outside of combat, but they're still serving the country. They're still in the military. And I honor those people during Memorial Day. I think of those people. I also honor the families of those that have died serving our country during Memorial Day.
And so my question is, what does Memorial Day mean to you? Do you have a different definition? Is it more constricted than my definition? Is it more expansive than sort of who I honor during Memorial Day? And the reason I ask this question is every Memorial Day, I'm reminded during this day about Jack Squires and others. Jack Squires, you remember in November, we had Jack Squires' daughter on, and she explained who her father was. I mean, Jack Squires was a coal miner's son. He was his mother's favorite son and a husband to a then 24-year-old wife and father to a 4-year-old. As I explained, he was a Navy SEAL who had survived harrowing missions in Vietnam. He earned a Bronze Star for his bravery and a presidential citation for his heroics. He was my friend and a teammate. And in the spring of 1975, while we were deployed in Europe, Jack was hit by an automobile while crossing a street in Athens, Greece. He fought to stay alive, but eventually succumbed to his injuries. And he died just shy of his 28th birthday. And every Memorial Day, I remember Jack Squires. So what's your definition of Memorial Day? What's your feelings? What do you think we should be celebrating this Memorial Day? Let's go to Bill and Barry. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I agree with everything you say, and I was a kid during World War II, and the people that were killed, a lot of them, were in the Merchant Marine. I have to, not just them, but boy, did they take chances. How many of them were killed, I don't know. But they all took a lot of chances. Some of those ships had Navy people on there manning guns. But there was more people than that. There were people over in England, and England was being bombed. So there's a lot of civilians who deserve our, we should honor them.
Hey, Bill, thank you so much for your phone call. I mean, the one thing that I often say is these deaths impact the family and in such a profound way. I mean, I was talking about Jack Squires. He was killed in Europe, but he was also a very heroic guy in Vietnam. But he was killed in Europe. And no matter when you're in the military, where you're killed, what circumstances it is that it happens, your families are so impacted. With Jack Squires, like I said, he had a 24-year-old wife, and he was the father of a 4-year-old daughter. That wife was widowed at 24 years old. Now, Jack was only 28, just shy of 28 years old. But think about this when a military member dies. I mean, if you look at Jack's wife, Barbara, for example, she was back in Virginia. It was like an ordinary day for her. She was shopping for groceries. She knew when she returned home that something was wrong. She was met by two SEALs and her mother. And they told her that Jack was badly hurt, but he was still alive. And they were trying to get her transported via flight to Athens. She was in Virginia trying to get her a flight to Athens. And she never made it on that flight because, as I said, Jack struggled to stay alive, fought to stay alive, but eventually succumbed to his injuries. And she never made it on that flight, and it was hours later. And we've seen this, we've heard this, when the Navy chaplain or a military chaplain comes and informs the now widow that her husband or partner, or nowadays it could be just the reverse, where a husband is informed that her wife has died in combat. You know, for those, I think about this every time, every Memorial Day. You know, life circumstances, particularly for those who serve in the military, you know, they can change in an instant. And when that loss happens, just think about it. You know, frequently a military member, when they lose their life, is in the prime of their life. For Jack Squires, it was 28. He was a week shy of 28 years old. And it must feel to them that the world, the family, that the world is collapsing in on them. There's perhaps this loneliness, even when they're surrounded by family and friends. Certainly that's what Barbara Squires felt when she was informed that her husband had died. And so, you know, you think about the family, and I think about this family in particular every Memorial Day, because Jack's mother would spend countless hours talking about her son, convinced that she was never being told what really happened. You know, there's this mystery about SEAL Team, and somehow she thought he was on a secret mission and doing secret things, and was never really told about what was going on. She never believed, for example, that he was killed by being hit by a car. You know, Jack's father hardly ever spoke of his son's death. But, you know, everybody knew how much it pained him. And what's probably one of the stories that were told to me about Jack's death, you know, his sister wept every time she thought about his death. But what was awful was that Jack had sent a postcard to her while heading to Athens from Italy, and it arrived 2 days after the funeral. You know, this is just, it sort of breaks a family up. And when you leave a child, as you heard in November, when you leave a child that's 4 years old, there is a void with that child, and there is this insatiable curiosity of who that parent was, because they don't remember that parent very well. So there's this void of who that parent was, and they need to fill that void. And in the case of what you heard from Tracy back in November, she's a woman in her 40s right now, and she spent years searching out those that knew her father, trying to understand who he was, and perhaps understanding about who she is. And as you heard, she felt better for the experience. You know, what I really appreciate is the fact that you, I don't appreciate this, but the fact that a death like this, whether with a military person, it gives you a greater perspective and appreciation of all that is those have served our country. And although this day isn't about those that served, it is certainly about those who have died, no matter what the circumstances. If you have an opinion, give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Tim in North Hero. Tim, you're on open mic. Good morning. Tim?
Yes, Mike. I guess today, I'm older, but for me, it's a day I remember the price and cost of freedom from the wars in the past, from the wars in the future, from the serving in the past and serving in the future. We are not who we are because we're weak. We are who we are because we're strong. But freedom is costly, and I hope nobody ever forgets that. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Tim, thank you so much for your phone call, and you are so right. I mean, you know, we kind of take that for granted. And when we think about a military member who has been killed, and again, my definition of who we honor today may be a little bit more expansive than yours. It is about those people who are killed while serving our country. Doesn't necessarily have to be combat, but the original Memorial Day was about those who died in wars. But to me, death, no matter how it comes to you while you're serving in the military, is something that we need to honor during
Memorial Day. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're talking about Memorial Day. What does Memorial Day mean to you? We would welcome your phone calls at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. It has a profound and somewhat expansive meaning to me. What does it mean to you? Let's go back to the phone line and let's talk to Carrie Ann in Ferrisburg. Carrie Ann, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. It's Jerry Ann, actually, and that's fine. I want to appreciate you for opening the concept that Memorial Day is for those who have fallen in war, but for those who have fallen outside of war but have served our country so well. And in particular, I think of my nephew, who is gone now, who served our country in Iraq, suffered a head injury, came back from the war, and wasn't quite himself. And he died while he was here because of drugs and other things that ended up becoming part of his survival to deal with his pain and PTSD, et cetera. There are a lot of walking wounded who are alive, or soldiers who served our country well, but there's a part of them that has died. And there are some of them who are suffering now, and there's some who have passed while they're here trying to make their life work, and it didn't work out for them after they served our country so well. So I choose to think of those folks and their relatives who are living with, it's hard to say what it is. It's not celebrating those who have served. It's not mourning those who have died. It's this in-between place for those who have served and are either living with this injury, quiet or not, or have died because of these injuries. And really, there's shame with the family. There's what did I do wrong? There's so many factors that can cloud one's ability to remember and honor that person so freely and openly. So I celebrate the fact that you are opening that idea, if you will, about Memorial Day and really thinking broader in terms of people who have served our country so well.
Thank you so much for your phone call. I appreciate that. It's true. I mean, my definition is broader, and I think Jerry Ann there does represent some of my thinking in terms of those that have served their country. It's more than just combat in sort of the way that they died. And I talked about Jack Squires, a combat veteran, a hero, and a Bronze Star for bravery and a Presidential Citation for heroics. And he died on a deployment to Europe, a SEAL team deployment to Europe. But he died walking across the street and being hit by an automobile. And I don't think, to me, a military death is a military death. And those that serve their country serve their country. You know, I escorted Jack Squire's body back to the military mortuary in Dover, Delaware, and also then on to the funeral home in Virginia Beach. And it tells you a lot about yourself, too. You get thinking about, if a tough guy like Jack Squires can die, then the reality is of death, it's not as abstract anymore. And service men and women are surrounded by this every day. Their experience, if they have a friend who dies or a teammate who dies or a platoon person who dies beside them, their experience doesn't change their passion for serving our country. They don't even balk at their obligations. It does remind you, though, it reminds us all of the outcome, and it gives you a greater perspective, as I said, and a greater appreciation of all those who have served our country. A really wonderful perspective. I want to take a few minutes and talk about military funerals are especially sad occasions, and what better time to talk about this than Memorial Day? A U.S. flag is folded from the casket and given to the family.
shots are fired in the air in honor of those deceased veterans. And there is this haunting sound of the bugle that you hear in the distance playing Taps. Think of that moment for a moment. Taps is played at the sunset of all military bases because it means a time of peace, of rest after a hard day. And it goes back to the Civil War to end the day of a warrior's day. And, of course, it's played at military funerals to seal the peace and the finality of eternal rest. There is no lullaby in our culture with greater or more lasting meaning. So in addition to honoring those who have been called to their final resting area, their final resting place, Taps reminds us that for those families left behind, peace may be hard to find in some cases. It may be many years before they find it. So I just urge you on Memorial Day this weekend, remember the veterans who have died serving our country. And those that have served, those who have died because of their injuries serving our country, as well as the sacrifice and suffering of their families. And for Jack, rest peacefully, my friend. That will end our week here at Open Mic, and I appreciate all your phone calls and all your time that you've given us. I wish you all a happy Memorial Day weekend. I wish that you think of those veterans who have sacrificed their life while serving in the military. It is especially an important holiday for me, and I hope for you too. If you ever want to listen to this broadcast, you can go on WDEVradio.com and click on the Open Mic icon and listen to the podcast at your convenience anytime, all the time. It is truly a new and interesting way that we broadcast nowadays, and it's one of the things that I hope you take advantage of. It's the Open Mic podcast. It allows you to go back, listen to shows that you've heard, or continue, or listen to shows that you haven't heard. I urge you also to listen to this show, because the callers really did make a difference in terms of understanding why we're celebrating this weekend. It isn't just to go out and travel and play and have a good time. It has a meaning to us all, or it should have a meaning to us all. You know what? I appreciate all your phone calls this week. There have been a number of phone calls. We've had great phone calls, and I really appreciate it. And I want you all to have a great weekend. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond, and of course streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Again, thank you for your phone calls. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.